That, please join me in welcoming Marilyn from the Pacific Group in Los Angeles.
Hi, I am Marilyn, and I'm an alcoholic. And I can't tell you how thrilled I am to be here in this gorgeous place. Just this very morning, I was sitting sort of tangled up in concrete and telephone poles and billboards near the 405 freeway in Los Angeles. And in a very short time, I came into heaven. And thank you. Thank you very much, Chris, for the invitation to come here and be a part of this amazing thing. I got to the airport, and there was Bob, and I just thought, gee, that's really nice that Bob would show up at the airport, and we'll go a few blocks to the retreat, and so it turns out that Bob lives pretty far from the airport, and drove all the way to the airport, and then drove all the way to the retreat, and just said, yeah, that's what we do. That's what you do after, what is it, 26 years of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bob radiates so much humility that it kept the car warm all the way home. And this is home. I really feel like I'm at home. I loved everything that Patrick said. More and more in Alcoholics Anonymous, I listen to somebody and I think, that person is telling my story, but he really addressed all of those things that I've encountered in this fellowship. My topic is very similar to Patrick's in a way, but different. It is coming to believe, and Patrick talked a lot about that because much of that involves this whole mystical thing, the third step. But coming to believe for me, coming from such a place of unreality and disbelief, has been a series of coming to believe this, and now coming to believe that, and now coming to believe and that, way beyond the first belief. When I was fairly new, and that was 35 years ago, this amazing program's kept me sober now for over 35 years. So there's a lot of power in this fellowship. When I was new, people would get up to the podium and heard a couple of times they would say, I came. Then I came to. And then I came to believe much later. That was certainly true for me. I came into the fellowship. And the first thing that I couldn't believe was that I was an alcoholic. Now, you would say, why then did you drift into Alcoholics Anonymous, of all places? That even has alcoholic in the name of it. And other people believed I was an alcoholic. That's why I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they kind of insisted. And I didn't know why. Now I look back on it and I realize that the clue that they were tuning into was the fact that I had lost my job because of drinking 5 or 6 years before. I was doing nothing but drinking. That was the clue. But I didn't pick up on that clue. So once I got here, I didn't stay. I came first in 1969 because of my attitude, and I didn't throw myself into the fellowship knowing that that's not really what's wrong with me. But I saw a person that radiated a kind of joy, a sense of purpose. Her name was Marion, but I didn't talk to her. I just saw that she seemed to have people around her, and they liked her a whole lot. All of my life I had wished that somebody liked me, and I spent a lot of time trying to get people to like me. I thought about it all the time, and the more I thought about it, the more convinced I was that they didn't like me. And then I thought about it some more, And then I became convinced that they were plotting against me. So Marianne clearly had a little coterie, a little group that just adored her. And then everybody else liked her a whole lot. So why didn't I talk to her? Well, I was kind of waiting for her to come over and say, I saw you across the room. I want to get to know you. You interest me. You look deep. I'd love to sponsor you. And if you let me sponsor you, I'm sure that in no time you'll be my very favorite sponsee. And she didn't do that. So I never talked to her. I went away and I drank. More people talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. One in particular, she was called my mother-in-law. So here I was. I came. Reluctantly, but I came. And the way I did was by trickery. I'd called the central office. Now, a wonderful person that has just passed on to the larger life, Clint Hodges, many of you I'm sure knew over the years. Anyway, he passed away, and he leaves a huge legacy. I find myself thinking of many things that he said, but this seems like a digression. It is, but it's relevant. Said there's three big kinds of prayers. Help me, give me, and use me. And they seem to go in that order in recovery. And in the beginning, my help me prayer was to call central office. And I didn't even know it was a cry for help. I was an atheist when I came to the program. I had a strong belief in the great God, no God, with all capital letters. I kind of worship the fact that there is no God and that the laws of physics and chemistry are so very elegant that they can accommodate, they can take care of every possible explanation we'd ever need. So that help me prayer was pretty much unconscious, but I called central office as I often did in those in-between days between the first visit to Alcoholics Anonymous and what happened was that was sort of social life for me. I'd call up to argue with the people on the phone. They were the only people that seemed to talk to me, and they didn't really want to talk very long. But that was my help me, and I didn't even know I was saying help. I'd say, I have a friend. And they'd say, have your friend call. And I'd say, I can't. Why not? Well, my friend, well, she can't use the phone because she doesn't have any hands. Well, we have to get off the phone now and help somebody who needs help. No, stay. I want to talk to you about God, that there is no God, and any program based on spiritual principles is bound to fail. And they'd say, well, that some people feel that way, but some of us find that power greater than ourselves seems to help, and we got to get off the phone now. But this day there was a strange person on the phone who asked questions, and she kept me on the phone. She found out my name and kept calling me by name. Now, Marilyn, are you sure you don't drink? Oh, I'm sure. Well, did you drink today? No, I don't drink. Well, when was your last drink? What do you drink? She just kept asking over and over. And finally, I admitted to her that I really was pretty much drinking only beer. Well, how many cases a day do you? Before long, I had given her my address, and she sent someone to get me. That's dangerous to do if you're talking with those offices. Don't give them your address if you're new and want to keep drinking. So, somebody came out, and I said, you know, I'm willing to go there, but do you know Marianne? I remembered this radiant creature. And my 12-stepper did not know Marion, but said she'd take me to a meeting, and I agreed to that because I wanted her approval. I desperately wanted everybody's approval in the whole universe. So this person who was paying a 12-step call, I just wanted to go along with her so she would like me and be my friend. But I dreaded going to this dreary, dreary fellowship. You know, it's a funny thing. Once you start to drink again, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous looks a little bit fanatic and crazy. And I explained that to her, and she said, just come along with me. That seemed what I needed to do to get her approval. So off we went with very low expectations. I just hoped I could just sit through that thing and get home and maybe console myself with just a little beer maybe, and then a little more, and then a little more, and then never ever go back again, and learn not to call that office anymore. So there was a coffee break, and after the coffee break, before I could doze off, the leader said, our main speaker tonight is Marion. And I looked up, and there was the radiant Marion. And I thought to myself in my alcoholic fog, that is a strange and remarkable coincidence. Unusual. And that night I seized the opportunity and did something I'd never done before. I approached Marion and grabbed tightly onto Marion and asked her to be my sponsor, and she agreed to do that. But you see, I had not come to, really, let alone come to believe. And what I had not come to believe was the fact that I'm an alcoholic. But I wanted Marion's approval. And so I loved everything that Patrick said, but one thing in particular, we should not discourage people who have not found God, who cannot do all of these steps with a deep, sincere belief. He emphasized actions, and as I look back on what's been terribly important to me are the actions that I took. I had to take the actions of belief, and what is that belief? Belief that I'm an alcoholic, so that I could pass, so that I could stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that I wasn't, and yet I seemed to be passing, and that was good. Marion seemed to give me pats on the head, and that was good. I probably would have gotten away with that for a while, but a strange and hideous thing happened. I was asked to give a 10-minute talk at my home group, and I thought, okay, rigorous honesty, have to be honest. I have to really lay it all out. I've never done that before. I've always tried to think, what do you want me to say? And then I'll say that. You want me to be a Russian princess? I'll be a Russian princess. Whatever, just give me some hints, and I'll be that. I'll tell enough lies so that we'll see if you're reacting, and if that looks good, then we'll go down that road. Okay, I was going to be honest. So I let it all hang out. I just bared my soul, and I talked about the pain I'd felt through life because of people misunderstanding me and never giving me just what I always wanted, and a lot of bad breaks, and causing deep existential angst. And then I talked about being an atheist, studying science and realizing that there is no God. And then I get back to existential angst. And finally, the secretary was showing sit down. And I wound up on a real kind of scientific upbeat note, I thought, which was, and after years of studying science, I have become convinced that the universe is one big, hideous wind-up toy. Thank you very much. And sat down. And 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 I ran over to Marianne at the break and asked, how did I do, how did I do? And she said, it was good that you said yes to AA. Yes, that's good. But you're going to have to start mentioning that you drank. And I was stunned because that seemed to have so little relevance to my life, to the pain in my life. Now, what the reality was that there had been a lot of pain in my life from selfish and self-centered living, of course, a lot of pain. But alcohol, of course, had been the solution. It had become the enemy, but I didn't recognize it as an enemy. It's like an insidious virus that can just stay dormant but eat up all kinds of important cells and you don't even know it until you're at the gates of sanity and death. And a sign. So I didn't know, but I wanted to please Marianne. So I began to talk about drinking and discovered, lo and behold, I had not only had I been fiercely dependent on alcohol, it had let me down in the way that it did other alcoholics. Why it was important for me to do that was that it allowed me to come to believe that I am an alcoholic. And that was the first important belief on this program for me, that I am an alcoholic. Why was that good? Well, it told me that this is the program for me. It was important for me to come to believe that. It allowed me to understand something else, and that was that since I had this disease, this malady, this spiritual sickness that plagues us all, since I had that, then maybe the solution would apply to me also. So that was just terribly important. But here I was, realizing that I've got this disease, but I'm not like the rest of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they seem to have a deep and abiding faith in this thing they call God. And I certainly did not have that. In fact, I had the conviction that the opposite was true. As I was sitting at the breakfast table this morning, now this is also a digression, but again, it seems to apply. We were just sitting there, and I turned to the one part of the newspaper I can bear to read these days, and that's the comic strip. And there was some cartoon, and it had a picture of cats going up to a house. Now, this is cats in the traditional or zoological sense of the word. Like Father Tom was talking about cat, pet. And so these two cats were going up the walk, and then another cat had come out of the cat door on the house. And the two that had come up the walk said something like, "We've come to talk to you about the all-knowing, all-powerful, invisible cat in the sky." And I thought, yep, in the old days, I would have just thought that was wonderfully funny because of all these silly people that come to the door to talk about the big, all-powerful, invisible cat in the sky. And so that's how I was now passing again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, I thought, in order not to make what I mean, and I tried that out on an old-timer, John Locke, who also has passed on, and he was just a wonderful man. He was died with 40-some years of sobriety, and he just laughed a lot. He just seemed to be unflappable, enjoyed life, and he listened to me, and what I thought was really complex logic of, I'm really saying these words that other people are saying, and they think that I'm praying to a higher power, but I know what I'm saying. I'm just thinking of this force that blah, 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 and I gave him the whole explanation. And then I ended up with, but I know what I mean. And he just laughed out loud, and he said, "Marilyn, I hate to break this to you, but that's what we're all doing. God, as we understand God, can be a telephone pole, but it's God as you understand God." And that, I guess, I'd heard that probably 785 times by that time. But when John Locke said it, I got it. That's okay. I talked to Marion about it, and she, too, did not care how I visualized my higher power. She just said, give lip service to it. So, again, actions were so important. She suggested these prayers, the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the prayer of St. Francis that our 12 and 12 talks about, the serenity prayer, the Lord's prayer. We have these lovely prayers, and if you put them all together, they take care of just about every aspect of life, especially if you throw in all those things on the wall like easy does it and first things first. And we are, in a way, a simple lot, but we probably have the essence of all spiritual organizations in these few things that we say when you think about it. So I was giving lip service to that, but really paying not too much attention to the words. But I was listening to the radio, and my higher power began to speak to me through the radio. Now, before you run out in terror, let me explain. There were a lot of songs, and I have always responded to music. I love music. I've always loved music, and it has saved me many a time. And as I listened to the radio, I heard these songs, and they would stay in my mind. You know how a song will play over and over and over. And then I'd go to an AA meeting, and I heard a woman get up to the podium. She began to talk about her children. And I remembered that I had three children, and I had been a bad mom to those three little children. They were still fairly small. They were 2, 4, and 5 when I got sober. And that's why a mother-in-law had been around all the time. I had a husband, too, and he was pretty worried, so he had imported his mother-in-law. And so I began to think about that as she was talking about her children and being an absentee mom and sometimes coming out of a blackout and wondering where they were. And I began to curl over in pain and guilt and just feeling bad. And then that Roberta Flack song was playing in my mind, killing me softly with his song. And that was what was happening to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was beginning to identify, but in the painful, painful kind of way. That was the real coming, too. I was becoming conscious, and my psychic nerve endings were tingling. And these talks were that Roberta Flack song, killing me softly with their songs. And then people suggested things like inventories and amends and sixth and seventh step and all kinds of esoteric things, which I resisted. But wanting to please, I found myself following along and doing those things. Then I began to hear other songs. Al Green was singing, I can see clearly now, the rain has gone. All obstacles are out of my way, or something like that. Rain has gone, waves. I should just try to pass. And so people would get together after the meeting and say the Lord's Prayer. That sounded very religious to me. But I would hold hands, and I would develop my own prayer, like whatever I could hold on to. One of the main things I could say while everybody else was saying whatever they were saying was, great force and power in the universe that brought Marion to that meeting that I was brought back to when I got sober. Whatever that was, that impressed me. And then I could say amen with everybody else. And that worked, and then I could shorten it. And one day I thought to myself, you know, I could just say God, and I could just say those words that other people are saying, but I know. And that was starting to happen. I was starting to see clearly now. And then one day I turned on the radio, and Cat Stevens was singing, Morning has broken like the first morning. And I looked out and I saw the sun for the first time. Sun that was happy. Before, sun had always seemed to be something malignant that was coming in to poison me. But something was happening in this strange fellowship. And I didn't have any words for it. But this strange and wonderful force that acts for our good was communicating in ways that I could respond. My sponsor, Marion, who just seemed to have the words to say that cut right to the quick. She instructed me on all of these things that were so important to me. God was using her in a profound way long before I ever felt that I could use and mean the word God as traditionally meant, namely some kind of strong supernatural force in the universe. She talked about God so easily and recommended a few books for me to read, which I did read. But mostly it was her voice, her telling me how to get the kids dressed, how to talk to my husband, just these simple things, finding God in the everyday. Coming to believe, the first thing that I had to come to believe in, above and beyond the fact that I was an alcoholic and that the program would work for me, was making friends with reality. I had never believed in reality. I always wanted it to go away. And I just felt that that I could never make friends with it. The world was much too cold, much too cruel. I'd been misunderstood. But that, I have come to believe, is what Alcoholics Anonymous does for us. It says, here you are right now. But I want to talk about getting a job again. No, no, that's off in the future. You're right here, right now. Do you have a job at this meeting? No. Well, here's the commitment, Chief. Go over and get a job at this meeting. That's a job. And I try to say, no, but I'm talking about writing a resume and going back to work. No, that's in the future. Now, go get a job at this meeting. The other thing that nobody wanted to talk to me about was the past. They'd just say, have you written an inventory? And I'd say, no, I want to talk to you about my suicidal depression, about feeling so guilty. Well, have you written an inventory? That's something you can do right now. Why don't you just get a pencil and paper and just sit down? I'll help you get started. Everybody wanted to talk about now. And the reason I didn't want to talk about now was that that's reality. And that's where I was always afraid to go. I had lived in the future. I'd lived in the past. I'd lived in fantasy. But I didn't want to live in the now. And Alcoholics Anonymous had such a strange and wonderful way, through its actions, getting me into action, of bringing me right here, right now. I didn't even know I wasn't living in now, but I was getting tripped up all the time. For example, I would think, I want Aaron to like me. Please like me, Aaron. So I'd go over and I'd say, hi, Aaron. How are you? Because Marion taught me to say that. And the first time I did something like that, I said, how are you? And she began to talk. And I was so happy because I could run back to Marion and say, I was in a conversation. And Marion said, that's wonderful. What did Aaron say? And I had to say, I don't know. I was thinking, I hope she likes me. And I was trying to think of what to say next. And Marion just said, oh, I understand. She was so gentle. Evidence that my higher power worked through her. She had the patience of Job. And she said, that was good. That was good that you were in a conversation. But now it's just terribly important to listen. If you listen, then you'll probably know what is the next thing to say. I had never thought of that. I thought that I had to use all of my brain power to try to devise that next thing and maybe a third thing so that whenever that other person stopped talking, then I could spring in with that thing I'd planned. And they were long gone before I ever had a chance to get to the third thing. And so what Marion was saying is, be here now. All right, let's be in a conversation. And go practice on Barbara. And then I'd try again, and I could listen. I could listen for a few minutes, but then I would go off in self-obsession. It was funny, books on tape were popular then. That was long before CDs. I mean, tapes were new. But that was nice. I was too nervous to read. But I could get a book on tape, and that would last a whole year. Because I'd listen for 2 minutes, go off in self-obsession. It would play on, and then I'd crank it back to 2 minutes, and then I'd listen for another 2 minutes, and then go off in 15 minutes of self-obsession. So they lasted a long, long time. And that's the way conversations were. I could just tune in a little bit at a time, just being here now. Now, why was that important? Because that was the place where I could hear things. That was the place that allowed me to meet you. I always wanted to meet you off by going out and planning something, developing my strategy, and then coming back and delivering it, and then making a big impression. Now, what can I say that would impress Scott? Maybe I'll talk about the role of calcium in excitation-contraction coupling. Would you like that? So it never worked. So here I was in the now. The now I found was painful in many ways because I'd never lived in the now and I didn't know how to live in the now. There were those moments when I once more had tried to come in and dazzle a whole bunch of people at an AA birthday party. And I like to make elaborate presents for people so they'd go, ooh, ah. And one time our group founder and leader, Clancy, who many of you probably know, he can be a little bit forceful now and then. He watched how I was just trying to get her to open my present and get everybody to say, ooh, ah. And that would mean that they liked me a whole lot and wanted to be my friend. And Clancy just came over and said, Marilyn, you like group noise too much. Why don't you just try to be an alcoholic like everybody else? You're going to make yourself terminally different, and you'll go out and drunk and die, and then we'll all be here happy. And I thought, this is the cruelest man I've ever met in my life. I stopped talking to him for about 17 years after that. He didn't notice, of course, but I felt it was good punishment. And just to let you know about the tricks and turns of Alcoholics Anonymous, Clancy's been my sponsor now for about 18 years. I don't know how that happened, but never say never in Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I know how it happened. I like active people, like this group up here in Portland. I am so stunned with the, well, like Bob going to any lengths and beyond today, and Chris and Barbara and all, everybody I meet just gets in, sponsors people. So I like to have a sponsor that just outruns me 100 times over. And Clancy just celebrated 80 years on Earth and will soon celebrate 50 years of sobriety. And he's getting on a plane every weekend and going off to carry the message. And he will speak at a meeting with three people, or he will just keep going. He says yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. He's one of the happiest people I know. And I like to have that model in front of me. So that is how. But that night at that party, I was kind of mad at him. But he told me something that was so terribly important. Just try to be an alcoholic like other alcoholics. But that was the problem with living in the now. You expose yourself to just deep and hideous public humiliation and to other kinds of psychic pain. But coming to believe in reality, coming to believe in the now was just terribly important because, as I said, that's where the sanding, well, I didn't say it, but this is true, that's where the sanding can occur. While I was living in the future and in the past and in outer space, I was invulnerable to that sanding process. I just had to get down with the troops. As Clancy said, be like other alcoholics. Take a job and go show up and make coffee and move the chairs around and do those things that I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And interact with people in such a socially clumsy way because I'd never done that in my life before. I had a sense of entitlement. They should all take care of me and pity me and give me everything I want and promote me in science and do all of these wonderful things. And I should give nothing in return and just act like a jerk. And they should like me a whole lot. And as long as I lived in my dream world, no sanding can occur. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I had to come down into this moment, I was subject to those things like, why are you acting like such a jerk, trying to get people to notice your presence? And why don't you notice somebody else's? Why don't you just become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Those were the painful lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous, cutting into line and having people say, bad dog, get back at the end of the line like all the other alcoholics. That's living in the now. That's meeting reality. No wonder I didn't like it. And yet I was finding out that this higher power that I didn't know yet was able to work on me in reality, in the now. The most painful part, though, was facing the fact that I had been a terrible mom to my kids and feeling the guilt about that, knowing that I had no relationship with my husband, even though we'd occupied the same house for quite a few years. I had a terrible relationship with my mother, with my mother-in-law, because I had heaped abuse on them, telling them to go home, feeling bad about that. They had usurped my place, and I wanted to get rid of them. They had saved the children's life. That's what they had done. And all of that began to sink in, and that was more reality. But again, that was allowing that pain to enter in the moment, in the now, so that this amazing fellowship could provide the remedy. The remedy, of course, is what? The steps that we take, the interaction with other people. And the sanding began to occur. As that was happening, ever so slowly, my life began to improve. Reality was not quite a friend, but it wasn't as painful as it was there when I first met it. One day, I just was sitting. I was sitting all alone, and I was thinking about people. I was thinking about Chuck Chamberlain, who was a frequent speaker when I got sober. And many of you are young, and you never met him. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. He was like Marion in that when he walked into a room, the whole room seemed to light up. Now, this may not be true, but this is the way I perceived these people. And he talked about God in a funny kind of way. He was from Texas, and maybe some of you have heard his tapes. He had a funny way of speaking, kind of a Texas accent, and kind of a drawl or a twang. And then he had this really weird laugh. Tee-hee-hee! And now, as I say, this may not even be true, but as I said, this is how I perceived it. And he'd say these funny things. He'd talk about God. And he was quoting the Bible, apparently, and I came from a family of atheists, so I didn't know what he was quoting from, so it wasn't so offensive to me. One thing is, fear not, little flock, it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And I didn't know what that meant, but it had a nice cadence to it. And then he'd say, he's our pappy, and we're his kids. Tee-hee-hee-hee! And at first I just thought, that is so sappy. Oh, that's embarrassingly bad. And yet, he knew something. He knew a great big thing. And I didn't know what that thing was, but I knew that he knew it, and he knew that it made him really happy and very attractive. And Marion clearly knew that great big thing. She just talked about it in such an easy way. And I was sitting there, and I just said to myself, I wonder if that big thing is really there. I wonder if it's real. And I thought this was just maybe scientific mind or what. I just looked into outer space, and I said, if you're there, I'd really like to get to know you. And if you're really there, and I got a little bit nervous, I said, and if you're really there, I'm willing to go on any path you choose for me. And I meant it. And I knew I was signing a huge, huge contract. And it made me nervous, but happy in an anticipation, because I knew Chuck Chamberlain was happy, and I knew Marion was happy. And I had begun to believe that something big was there. And I just signed my life over to it. Now, if that big thing was what I thought it was, it had my life anyway. I mean, think about it. But I thought I was being really generous. That was so different from any kind of thoughts I'd had about God before in Ohio. I thought that people talked about God, and it seemed closest to Santa Claus, because it was some kind of a God that you could say, if you're there, I'll believe in you, and if you're really there, do my will. Get to work for me. Here's my agenda. I want this job. I have a sick friend. I want that person to be well. So that somehow just did not seem to be true, because you can do tests on that. I guess people do tests, and God often fails those tests. So God is not Santa Claus. I had concluded that. But there, I had to accept that there is something way beyond human power. I mean, just given the clientele. I mean, my friend Charlie, now you came from the Tiki Bar, was that it? Tiki Lounge. Humdinger. Something with tiki. Humdinger, okay. And other places. And and Chris. Chris is, I would say, one of the healing forces in this fellowship. And if you listen to his story, you would never want him to heal you. I mean, it's got to be somebody else. And yet we do come together. And what happens? I mean, what does happen when alcoholics come together? Well, we hit each other over the head with chairs and break bottles over each other's heads. I mean, that's a bar, right? And yet we come together in a place like this, and we are all getting well. We are all moving to some place that allows us to say that it just gets better and better. Maybe it doesn't even get better by worldly standards, but it gets better to us inside, and that's really something. That's really something when you think about it, that other people might look at us and say, boy, that person's had a lot of bad luck, and that person just, I'm happy, happy, I'm serene and joyful. How can that be? That's pretty amazing. So I suspected that there was something big there. So I just made that little bargain. Now I realize that I had already come to believe in that big, big thing. I just didn't have a name for it. I didn't have experiential knowledge of it, really, except I did. I had all of those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, all of those conversations with Marion and my new friends. I had those moments with the women that I sponsored that were precious beyond words, where I could see them get through a difficult time and not drink and share these stories together. I began to see that I'm growing up with my children, and I began to see that there is something really, really big in that relationship, and I don't even know what it is. something that would allow me to sit on Susie's bed, our baby, Susie, as she was becoming a teenager with a broken heart over a boyfriend that had just been a jerk. She had seen him in front of Rocky Horror Picture Show with his arm around Amber. And I said, if you just get through tonight, if you live through tonight and put a few days together, you'll see eventually that Tom is a jerk. And she did. She came to believe that he is a jerk. And we grew up together. But I still didn't have a name for it. And I didn't even realize I was having experiential knowledge of this big thing. So as I said, I made this prayer. Now I look back on that time and just laugh at myself as other people laughed at me in those days. Now I can laugh at myself too. That the transformation obviously had occurred. Otherwise, how could I say, I want to get to know you and I'm willing to go on any path you pick for me? That meant I was already on the path. That's been true of me in Alcoholics Anonymous from day one. Something deep, deep inside in my spirit comes to believe, knows. And then something in my heart responds and comes to know, comes to believe. And I don't even have words for that thing. And then I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I hear somebody talk, like Patrick tonight. And that gives words, that gives expression to this thing that has been happening all along. And I say, oh yeah, it's that relationship with my children. Yes, that thing is happening. And then finally, the last to know is my mind. And on that day, when I made that prayer, I'm willing to go anywhere you pick for me. I was already on the path. Of course I was going anywhere it picked for me. I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have truly come to believe that it's pretty much synonymous for us as alcoholics to say two things. One is, I am an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm trying to say yes to everything that AA asks for me. Of me, and I am trying to be a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can say that, or you can say, and I am trying to do God's will. And I believe that if I am being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and saying yes to that, I am doing God's will. And why do I say that so? Because I look at my life and it's been coherent. I have come to know that big thing so well that I very easily converse with that big thing that every now and then, in fact all the time really, gets so small that it can live right inside of me. And yet it seems to permeate the whole universe. I guess we're sort of like sponges in a great big ocean. It lives inside of us, and yet there's the ocean. It fills up the ocean. And yet we are permeated by it like a sponge. That's how I feel about it now. So it's there all the time. And I can call it God, this big thing. And I know that it's responsible for my healing, my transformation, all the joy in my life, my good relationship with my children and my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only thing that gives me power as a sick and crazy alcoholic to have anything of value to say to the women I sponsor. I think we're a part of this great big thing, and we're the luckiest people on earth. Thank you.
Okay, sit down. Ready? All right, Marilyn.
Ah, a question. Thank you. Hi, Beth. The question is, do I have to, are there moments now when I am looking for that higher power, wondering if it's there that will bring me to sanity, right? Uh-huh. Oh, sure. Because I want to live in the future and I want to live in the past. And that power that's available just never goes there with me. And I have to embrace reality, act like I love reality, give it a hug, essentially, just to stay grounded there. And then I am empowered to be sane. I'm never sane in my thoughts. I have a lot of zany thoughts, and I enjoy them. But I act sane if I'm in the moment and I am asking for that power. If nothing else convinced me of this great power that's available to all of us, it would be that I pass for normal in the world. And I function, but it is that I just go from this moment to this moment. And my prayer is, God, hold on to me. God, don't let go of me in those scary moments. And a scary moment for me can just be almost anything, like crossing Wilshire Boulevard. God, please hold on to me. I don't know. And I ride my bike in West LA, so I pray a lot. And that power is always there, in that moment. A friend that's been very important, Gene Lunsford, another person who's passed on, was at another place in sobriety where she said her only prayers now are, thank you, I love you. And I thought that's a nice thing to aspire to, where we are just at that place where all we need to say is, thank you, I love you. And I think if we live in that place, there are no doubts about sanity. We're not afraid, because I think at that moment we have embraced reality and know that it is all good. As long as I am there, I am empowered not only to get through that moment, but to enjoy it. So, thank you. Yes. Hi, Celine.
Mm-hmm. And I have two children now, and I got sober. I had two small children. And my question to you is, do you ever have moments to this day, and mm-hmm. in line with came to believe, mm-hmm. do you ever have moments of that guilt when mm-hmm. you were drinking mm-hmm. when they were young? What do you do in those moments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The question is, what do you do about the guilt that you feel as an alcoholic mom? And that plagued me. I don't have it now, thank God. And it's been 35 years of making living amends to my kids. So somewhere along the way, that was removed pretty much entirely. I suppose I could work up a guilt if I, in my self-obsession, I really tried, but I never think about that. And I find myself saying to the women that I sponsor, I used to feel that way. And then once you begin to use the past tense, you realize some amazing transformation has occurred. With each one of them, I think that, and I've often talked about this, and it's kind of a long answer, but it, I think, is relevant. I began to punish the children without even knowing it because of my guilt of all things. I mean, as if it weren't bad enough that I would be a bad absentee mom. Then I get sober, and it took the longest time for me to realize that my guilt about them was harming them. And how is it harming them? Well, it took this form. I would look at our daughter, Becky, and I would think, I want her to play the cello, because if she plays the cello and if she could play it really well, they would never suspect me of being a bad mom. And I would say, play the cello. I bought her a cello, and she took lessons, and she wanted to play the guitar and have a rock band. And I just thought, if she does that, then they will think she probably has an alcoholic mom. She's in a rock band. And so I would not allow her to follow her dream. or at least I didn't support it. And our son, likewise, I wanted him to be good in mathematics. Because again, how could some boy that goes to school and aces a test in mathematics have a bad mom? They'd all think I'm okay. But if he doesn't do well, they'll suspect that mom has somehow ruined his mind and poisoned him in some kind of way. And then Susie was the baby, so we just kind of ignored her. So these children were not really getting great benefits of my sobriety there at first. Now, what happened to me, though, was funny. Again, that's why I'm such a great believer in these actions that we take. I was told to write inventories about this situation and get down all of these bad things that I felt about driving around in a blackout with my kids in the back seat, being a negligent mom, never reading stories to them, sitting out in the garage drinking beer while my mother-in-law and my husband ran stories, blah, 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 and just on and on. I just wrote page after page after page after page after page of stuff. But that was just the beginning. Then people talked about amends, making living amends and doing that and feeling worse all the time. Thinking this guilt is only getting worse. Feeling acute pain, going to meetings, sobbing through the meetings, telling people about all the guilt I felt about the children, and they'd say, guilt is a selfish pastime. That's a character defect. You should pray to have it removed. And I'd pray to have the guilt removed, and then I would say, Becky, play the cello. Dear God, please remove the guilt. Becky, you're not practicing the cello. And that was going on and on. And what happened was that I was still doing the best I could. And that's why I'm such a believer. If we give ourselves over completely to this program, take the steps, do what our sponsors suggest to us, try to follow along, say yes, something is happening. Even though my brain was still in outer space, and way off the track, we were up in San Francisco in this year where I felt the most guilt. And I often talk about this, so tune out if you've heard this one before, but it is relevant that we were living next to a school called the Los Amigos School, and it was for special children, and they were handicapped, mentally handicapped, all of them, and mental ages of 2 and 3, and yet they were big kids, and they played out in the play yard. And what I was seeing without really seeing was that they were a really happy lot there at that school. And I wasn't getting it until one night I took my 3 kids over to the play yard and mom had come back with her son. And he was big, I don't know, maybe 10 or 11. I never can estimate, but, you know, big. And yet he could not speak very clearly. He was having trouble walking. She got him out of the car and brought him over and strapped him into a swing. And we were kind of there on the play yard, and I was beginning to watch that because they clearly were having such a good time, and she began to swing him, and that made him laugh. He just started laughing, and he was having such a good time, and it was in the evening, and there was light coming through the trees, and it was shining on his face, and it was a beautiful face, and this laughter, and then I could see the light on her face too, and she was smiling and so happy, and it was so clear that there was perfect love between them, perfect love, and she saw him as her perfect son, and it was clear that he thought, this is the perfect mom. They just had something going that didn't quit. And I looked at my kids that I had pushed away, and I was afraid of them because they were bringing out all of my guilt. And I could see light on their faces now. And I just saw them as perfect, perfect children of God. I had been making amends all along, but in that moment, this God that I had come to believe in just gave me this snapshot, really, and said, see, we're all children of God. We're all perfect here on earth. No matter what our IQ is, no matter whether we play the cello, no matter whether we're sick with muscular dystrophy, we're all perfect, just as we are. And God is encouraging us to grow into that next thing that God wants us to be. And God sees the whole picture, the forever picture. We see this little tiny lifetime that seems so big to us. We don't know what the plan is, but each one of us is a perfect child of God when God looks at us. And God is just cultivating us like fine plants in a garden. And I got to see my children, I think, sort of in the way that God sees my children. And I realized that God is the parent. Not really me. I'm just here babysitting. But my real role is to share experience, strength, and hope. We'll grow up together. And I said, let's go home. And from that point on, we started growing up together. And that was the moment when much of that guilt dropped to the side. And Becky threw away her cello, started playing, and eventually played in a rock band. Went on to be an engineer so she could earn a living. But had fun. And David actually did turn into a mathematician of sorts. And then Susie, the one we didn't pay any attention to, grew up, and she's now a professor in a medical school at Notre Dame, in fact. And she became the scientist that I had always tried to be. And I think it was just because I finally stepped aside and I allowed them to respond to this force in the universe that wants us to grow into what we were put on earth to do. And, okay. Yes.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Aaron.
I've had this problem throughout my sobriety that I was hoping maybe you could shed a little light on, mm-hmm. and that every time I become comfortable with an idea of a higher power, God, I think to myself, how could there really be a God if horrible things happen to mm-hmm. lots of people every day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you hear the question? How can there, it's that kind of thing, how can bad things happen to good people, and how can there be a loving God if there is just so much chaos in the world? I really am just at a place where I kind of have to tune out a lot of that chaos. And that's probably putting my head in the sand, but that's why I just read the comics. I understand, because I was there for so many years, how that's one of the big arguments against any good force in the universe. My way of coming to terms with that, I would say, is that, as I hinted at in the last thing about the children, it's my belief. Of course, everything we say at an AA podium is our belief, so that's the disclaimer, but I think we see only in part. We see this lifetime, and I think this force that we come to know is very big and sees forever. And I think we are evolving. And there are probably two things we have to do in our lifetime. And that is, first of all, just be here, just experience it. But if we want to tune in to this force that I think permeates the universe and is available, I think that there are only two things we have to do, and that is learn the spiritual lesson from this time through, this particular phase, what we see as beginning with birth and ending with death in this lifetime, which I think is very small compared to God time, which is billions and billions, as Carl Sagan says, billions, billions and billions of years. That's very short. So we see that. And our assignment, we only have to do two things from birth to death. That's learn the spiritual lessons and carry out the assignments. Now, we really don't have to do that. There are just some people who drink and die and never tune into that. And I just think that they evolve too. I believe we're all going to the same place. And people that seem to do what we consider very antisocial things, they're probably not learning their spiritual lessons this time around, but we just see this part. when we begin to tune into this thing that's available to us, we don't have to drink anymore. And we begin to evolve in some kind of spiritual way. As I say, God is saying, you're fine just like you are, but here, if you cooperate with my plan, we'll just bring you into a more surrendered state, a little bit more joy, a little bit more happiness. And that seems to be also wrapped up with this second part, which is to carry out the assignments. And for us, the assignments usually are, go talk to that newcomer. Our sponsor gives us assignments. Why don't you help clean up? That's an assignment. And then we get other assignments, like, here's a job. You have a boss, and the boss will tell you what to do. And we can cooperate with the plan, and we never know where we're going to be of help. And I think that by doing that, we are accomplishing the two things, spiritual lesson and the assignment. What seems to happen is that wherever we're going, this thing that God has in mind for us, we don't go alone. I mentioned Clint Hodges. That was one thing that struck me, was that he seemed to know that wherever he was going, he wasn't going to go alone. And it's better just to keep pushing other people along too, taking people with him. And that seems to be the fastest way that we move along in this, whatever this evolution is, that's always taking us to that happier place. The more people we're taking along with us, the faster it seems to go. So the world just spins on and on and on, and people are learning weird, strange lessons. And I've been helped by my daughter, who has really come to believe in a big way. This is the one that she just became a professor in a medical school, and she feels like that's way beyond her. So she really had to turn to God because she knows she can't do it. So I was talking with her about a bad thing happening to a good person. And she said, well, you know, that really is between that person and God. And maybe it's only bad from your perspective. And I just thought, and this is our little daughter. This is our baby that I am learning that from. So many, many times I just have to let, well, like there's a thing, somebody was real worried because there was a Sufi tribe, and they were dancing and spinning and spinning, and it was really getting on somebody's nerves. And this person went over and talked to a wise person and said, these Sufis, they're spinning, and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, they seem to be worshiping, but I, what can I do? And he said, let them spin. And that's the way with the world. It's just spinning in a crazy way in many areas. But I just always remember, let them spin. But I have to come back now, here. What's my assignment here? What do I have to do here? And that's all I have to do. Just those two things. Cooperate with the plan, learn the spiritual lessons, take care of my little assignment, whatever it is. Yes, Scott.
Hi, Scott.
Came to believe in a power greater than ourselves to restore us to sanity. Mm-hmm. Did you ever, at one point, look back on your life and ever believe that you were ever sane?
No. Uh-uh. That's the part of that step that just always sounded a little bit funny to me. I just don't quarrel with much that's in the big book. But that one, I would say, it might have been better, not instead of restore, just bring me to sanity, or give me some sanity. But maybe in the old days, people were sane before they started drinking themselves to death. You know, there is that thing in A Vision for You that our book is meant to be suggestive only. We constantly know that God will reveal more to us and to our fellows. Things change, but it's not sane to be drinking yourself to death. living the life that most of us live. No, that's not sanity. No, most of us do not want to be restored to what it was like. So, yeah. Yes, Chris.
Marilyn, you mentioned that you used science, you used physics and chemistry to disprove God.
Mm-hmm.
Have you, with your science background and so forth, now later on used science to prove God?
No. The question is, you use science to disprove God, but can you use it to prove God? No, that's a funny thing that I don't think that you can ever prove God. I mean, okay, I think it's impossible to use science to prove to another person that God is. I can tell you, and I used to do this, I used to torture newer people by trying to say, this is what I found, especially if I got somebody that says, I'm a graduate student at UCLA and I'm an atheist. Oh, that's wonderful. Let's sit down and talk about God. And their eyes would just glaze over and spare me the making the Dracula go away. And so I guess all I can say is that this is what I did. If you do these things and you're an alcoholic, then you will have a spiritual awakening. I mean, it's guaranteed by our 12th step. And it will be just right for you. And it seems to be different for just about every person. And I think that that's as near as we can come to any kind of practical thing. If you do what I do, you will feel something similar to what I feel. You will come to know. You will come to believe in this big force that acts for our good. The one thing that I think makes me grateful for science, and I'm still involved in a couple of things at UCLA that, in fact, right in this moment, I have to make a presentation on unsolved problems in medicine and immunology. So I've been reading about the immune system and how complex it is. And the last time I read about the immune system, much less was known, and now there is such complexity, how there are antibodies and complement and T cells and macrophages, and they all work together, and there are billions and billions of them, and they can take care of invading bacteria. That's just one tiny aspect of science and creation. And I begin to look at this complexity, and I think, on the very small level, whether you're talking about parts of our body and T cells and macrophages, or the very small parts of the atom with elementary particles and complexity of that and string theory now, or the very big with universes and multiple universes and many dimensions and black holes and white holes and all of that stuff, I just think that this thing that we have access to understands all of that, if not directing it. But that's what I think is the gift of combining science and Alcoholics Anonymous, is just having those moments where I just see, my gosh, what we're dealing with. And we have access to that any moment just by getting quiet and saying, hi there. That intellect, that power. And all it asks us to do is just come along. Let's go together. It's, I think, a dance. And as we dance with God, we get to see this force. We get to experience it. And then if we take the lead, then we begin to step on its toes, and it disappears. So. Okay, yes.
Speaking of macrophages, it appears to me that you have come to believe, have you ever experienced that you believe in this big thing so much that you decided that at one point that you better not
ask that big power for help because you wanted to do something that wasn't right.